I don't know when you think of the attributes of God, at least for me, I don't know if there's one that really means more than God's goodness. You are looking at a blessed man. You say, well, you don't look that blessed to me. You just don't know what's on the inside. I know there's not a lot of raw material on the outside, but you are looking at a man that God has been good to me my whole life. I was talking with one of our fine men yesterday, and he said, well, welcome to the Geezer Club. And I said, it's a good club. And I told him, I said, from the time that I was born until now, there's never been a period in my life when God has not been good to me. Now, that doesn't mean that I haven't had problems. When I was probably less than two, my parents split. I lived on a farm. I was born in Jacksonville, but I lived on a farm until I was five, and my mom remarried. And there are a lot of times when step-parents are awful with kids, but I hit the jackpot with mine. I consider my stepdad to be my dad. I went to a school as an elementary kid, and it was a great time. We didn't have air conditioning. We had big windows. I'm talking about big windows. And they were only about that high from the ground. And there was a math teacher that was in one of the sixth grade classes, and I always wanted to be in her class. And this was why. Because when she would turn her back to the class and was writing on the board, some of the boys that were friends of mine would jump out the window and go around the store, around the corner to Shorty's little convenience store. And she'd turn around and start talking. She didn't even miss them. And then she'd turn around and start writing something else, and they'd jump back in and get back in their seats. And I have those kind of stories, and I had friends that I played Little League baseball with, and then I went to junior high school. That's how you know that I'm dated, because we called it junior high back then. Then the Lord saved me, and I got to hang out with other saved teenagers. Went off to Bible college. Some of the dearest friends that I have are people that I met during my college years. One of those dear friends is a fellow that has been my CPA now for about 45 or 46 years. He's not a member of this church, but he and I have been friends. His brother and I played basketball together for our college. He was here at my little birthday thing yesterday. Just blessed my heart seeing him. Usually I see him once a year, and that's about tax time, and I'll find out how his grandkids are doing and say, I'll see you next year. But he was here yesterday. I got to start working at this church in 78. And we just never left. We tried to a couple of times. I thought when I turned 30, I'd go pastor somewhere. But the Lord either didn't, well, evidently the Lord didn't want me to go, because I wanted to go, because I wanted to be the pastor. But with the times that I wanted to go, the church that I was preaching at didn't want me, they didn't want me, and so it never worked out where either I was comfortable or they were comfortable. And so I would tell Debbie, I would say, I don't know what God's doing with me. I don't know what God's doing with us. And she would say, I just can't believe that you don't believe that all things work together for good. And I'm thinking, why don't you just shut up being spiritual? You know, I mean, always got to be spiritual, you know. I mean, I'm wanting to get into mully grubs, you know, and she's wanting to be spiritual. And so we just stayed. But now there's very few preachers that have the ability to say that they've been at one church knocking on 48 years. Very few people can say that. I hope God lets me stay here. I may not be able to be the pastor, but I hope God lets me stay here for many, many more years. God's been good to me. Let me tell you how good God is. This is not about me. This is about one of our families. Last Sunday night, we had one of the finest ladies in this church, and she was singing a song. And she was carrying a burden that only a handful of people knew about. But she had a 15-year-old granddaughter that they knew nothing about where she was at. She had run away. They didn't know what city she was in, didn't know anything about where she was at. And she began to just say, "Would you please pray for my granddaughter?" We called the church to the altar last Sunday night. We prayed. And it was either 2 or 3 days later, they got word that she's okay. That's God. That's the kind of thing that God does. He's a good God. Can I tell you that God's been good to our nation? God has been so good to us. Last evening, yesterday ended up being a big day. Debbie and I we had plans after the summer birthday bash, or not birthday, but summer breakfast kickoff bash, which turned into a breakfast bash or birthday bash. I'm going to get it straight in a minute. After that, had plans to go home, do some things at the house, and then all of a sudden, our two older grandkids, "You want to take us out to eat?" So we went out to eat. Then it was some friends from out of town. "Hey, why don't you come see us?" And so we got home about 8:30 last night. We were tired. We had those plans, but sometimes plans change. I think about how that the Lord just brings things together. But I know this, I know that God has been so good to us as a people. In that conversation last night, we were talking about the places that we have visited, and I was telling them that I've been to Israel 4 times and about to go a 5th time. One of the places that we have been to, I think that it may have been at Masada, but there was a rock that was there that was a flat rock that had a little hole on it, and they were asking the people, and they said, "What do you think that is?" And few people knew. Most people did not, and they said, "That's where wealthy people could go to the bathroom. They could sit there just like, basically, in the 1900s, we had outhouses, plywood, holes." You know, we had a preacher preaching this pulpit one time at a preacher's fellowship. He said at our house, he said, we were wealthy. He said, we had 2 holes. He said, one of them was small. And he said, my daddy told me, he said, now don't use the big one. That's for your mama. And all I'm thinking is, that don't sound right. But they had that hole there. And I said, the archaeologists like digging in that area. And my friends are like, that sounds horrible. I said, well, evidently you don't get geeked up like an archaeologist does. But I said, you think about this. You think about kings in just a few decades ago. Do you know that our poorest people have it better than they did? I don't know if I'll get to this story or not, but one of our presidents was James Garfield. And he was assassinated, but there was a guy that was living kind of a little bit before him, and he ended up getting in a duel, and both the guys got shot, but he died of an infection. You know what we do when we get an infection nowadays? We go get an antibiotic. You get ready to have tooth surgery. Give you an antibiotic 3 or 4 days before that. Why? Get it in your system. Kings died from that kind of stuff. And our poorest people live as royalty today. That's how good God has been to this nation. And yet, what do we have? We have people that will not even acknowledge that there is a God, much less that he's a God that raised this country up. You have people that serve on city councils that will not face the flag when a prayer is being invoked and the Pledge of Allegiance is given, but yet they have been elected to city councils. That does not speak well for people that do the electing. When people hate this country, I don't think that God's I don't think that God's name, of course, is honored, but I don't think that the people are honored by the choices that they make. You and I, we've got a lot of problems in this country, but can I tell you, even with all our problems, it's the best one going? Every time I watch a newscast and I get aggravated about something, and that's often, I always check myself and go, but it's the best place of any place. The people that hate this country the most, they don't have another place they want to go. They just want to destroy what we got. But I'm glad that God doesn't have me sitting on a rock going to the bathroom. I got bathrooms all over the place. We got bathrooms at this church. We got 6 toilets at our house. Hey, if you want it at our house, you can find it. We have running water. We have power whenever we want it. We can get gasoline. Now, we may not like it being $4 a gallon, but they're paying $8 in California. I know it's communist, all right? But $4 a gallon is still a lot to me. I was looking at a card that my daughter Allison had given to me about what happened in 1956. Gas, 25 cents a gallon. I remember it being 35 cents a gallon, and I was ticked off at Jimmy Carter when it went to $1 a gallon. I never liked Jimmy because of that. I liked him better when he ceased to be president than he was when he was president. I was glad when he went back and started raising peanuts again. But it's still the best place going. Can I tell you, I'd rather pay $4 a gallon than to have San Francisco get nuked. I'd rather pay $4 a gallon than to have New York get nuked. You say, what do you mean by that? Do you not know that that's the reason that Iran keeps trying to drag these negotiations out? They're trying to get their nuclear program started again. Those people are lunatics. They are a death cult, the people that are in charge of that country. We ought to be willing to save our people by the thousands. We ought to be willing to do whatever is necessary to see that they do not have a nuke. And so I'm got a lot of introduction going here. I want to read something to you. Tell me if you know where this is from. And for the support of blank, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Anybody know where that comes from? Which one? The what? Nope, not the Bill of Rights. What? Declaration of Independence. That's exactly right. It's the Declaration of Independence. 56 signers. You've heard somebody say, put your John Hancock right there. John Hancock signed it large. And so when somebody says, put your John Hancock there, that is a reference back to the Declaration. 56 men. 3 of them are from Georgia. This county that we're in, Gwinnett County. Do you know that there was a man whose last name was Gwinnett? First name was Button, like a button on a vest. Button Gwinnett. When I first got to the church, some of you that have been here a long time, you remember Brother Don could say some words. Up in Lawrenceville, which was the county seat, there used to be a little hospital up there. And he said, Brother Tom, or Brother Tummy, He didn't call me Tommy. It took him forever to say Tommy. Brother Tommy, I need you to go to Lawrenceville. We got somebody at Butner Gwinnett. It's Butner Gwinnett. It wasn't Button Gwinnett. It was Butner Gwinnett. And that's when I started visiting hospitals. I don't think I'd ever been to visit a hospital except maybe when my dad had his surgery. But Button Gwinnett signed the declaration. Anybody ever heard of Lyman Hall? A couple of you. What about the county that Gainesville, Georgia's in? Hall County? Lyman Hall lost everything that he had. Why? Because he was willing to put it all on the line for this nation. What about the county where many of us live? That way, about a mile and a half. George Walton, signer of the Declaration. What did these guys have happen? Well, five of them were captured by the British. I think it was Walton that may have been the one that was captured in Savannah when the British occupied Savannah. You had these guys that had children that were killed. There was one that the British had taken over his home, his homestead. He had a plantation. They had confiscated it. Everybody had been run off. And he looked at the troops, American troops, and they said, "This is your house." He said, "Shell it." In other words, destroy my house because they are using my house. Just destroy it. These 56 guys, many of them died as paupers because they were willing to put their lives on the line. I reread this morning around 6:15. I was looking at the declaration about that time, and they're just listing the grievances that they had against George III. This is what he said, and this is what he's doing. And because of what they were willing to sacrifice, you and I have the blessings of sitting in a nice air-conditioned church. We don't have to worry about somebody trying to knock our doors down and shoot us in here. We don't have to worry about somebody, you know, coming in and saying, "Well, we're fixing to lock that preacher up." It may come to that. They're already doing that in Canada. They're doing it in Britain. They're doing it in Ireland. They're doing it in Scotland. But it hadn't got to the shores of America yet. My guess is that if it comes, then there'll be many of us that'll just say, "All right, let's go. We'll go to jail." But it's not here yet. And so even though the times that we live in are sometimes irritating, sometimes discouraging, it is no different than the times that we're going to look at this morning. And I want to give you some of these this morning. I want you to go with me to Jeremiah chapter 29. Now, Jeremiah is called a weeping prophet. And the reason that he's called a weeping prophet is because he probably preached for 40 years. He preached for a generation. And nobody listened to him. I mean, I'm just like, that guy had to be just lower than a snake's belly button with his disposition. Can you imagine standing up week after week after week after week after week? And not only do people not respond and do what you're saying, this is what the Lord is expecting, they do just the opposite. And then you had preachers that were also on the scene, and they're going, "Oh, Jeremiah, all he does is just preach negative messages." I don't like to be a negative preacher, but let me tell you something. If you don't have a negative terminal on your battery, your car don't start. Sometimes you can be positive, and sometimes you got to be negative. It all depends on the circumstances. But I know this, that people that do not obey and follow God, God's judgment follows that. Jeremiah is preaching. He is weeping. You have him saying, you're going into captivity. They're coming. There's going to be judgment that falls. And you've got prophets in there saying, No. They may come, but it'll only be for a short time. And Jeremiah's going, No, it's going to be for a while. We'll get to that when we get in our text in a second. But he is a weeping prophet. 20 years before they are conquered, he's preaching, and they go, just hush. You read about that in chapter 27 and 28. But then chapter 29, though, something is different. It's not a judgment that is being preached. It's not a despondency or something that's going to be discouraging. There is an oasis in the midst of a desert. He begins to tell them something. There's going to be trouble, but it's going to ultimately be okay because of the result. And that's what I want you to see today. I want you to see that. Now, there are three different times, and I want you to keep this in your mind. There are three different times that the Babylonians, under a man named Nebuchadnezzar, came and basically conquered Israel. First time, 605 BC. In 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar came against the country of Israel and Jerusalem, and for the first time, Jerusalem has fallen. Never fell during the time of David, never fell during the time of Solomon, but now it is falling. You've got him, and what does he do? He takes some people into captivity. He takes the king. He takes the queen. He takes the priest. He takes the prophets. He takes the eunuchs that live in the palace. He takes the carpenters. He takes the blacksmiths. He takes all of those people into captivity. Now, you know by name some of those. Anybody ever read the book of Daniel? Daniel is the one that's taken. You remember the three Hebrew children, Nart, Hark, Shaphner, and Marx. We're talking Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those three. You got all the people that are skilled with their hands. You got all the people that can do artistry with metalworking. You've got people that are servants, much like the eunuchs. Every one of those, they are now slaves in Babylon. Well, when the king is now taken into captivity, his son takes over. Well, they begin to run their mouths again. The people of Israel do. So what does Nebuchadnezzar do? Comes back for a second time. That is in 597 BC. He comes back, takes them again, takes the king, which is the previous king's son, takes him into captivity. And so what happens? There's a man named Zedekiah, and he decides what we're going to do is we're going to try to get some nations together. And we're going to let those nations, we're going to form a coalition. It's going to be, you know, like the first NATO. We're going to have a coalition. And what does old Jeremiah do? He comes walking in. He's got a yoke on his neck. And he goes, I don't care what you boys are doing. God's sending judgment. You might as well just submit so it won't be any worse than it's already going to be. And there was another prophet, Hananiah, and he goes, why don't you just shut up? You read that in between the lines of the Hebrew. Just hush. He takes the yoke and he breaks the yoke and he says, yeah, Babylon's taken us twice, but it's only going to be, you know, maybe a couple of years this time. And Jeremiah goes, that's not true. Yes, it is. And he's trying to preach a positive message, and Jeremiah's going, I'm telling you, God said that's not true. And so then there's the third time and the final time, and this is when the temple gets robbed. This is when everything gets destroyed, and there is nothing left but basically rubble, old people, infirm people. That's all that's left. Everything of value is gone. And so you have these three deportations. Now, quickly, I want to give you four quick things and we'll be done. But I want you to remember the times in which they lived, and then you think about the times in which we live. They lived in a desperate time. We live in desperate times when we have people with PhDs that make asinine statements like men can give birth. 8 billion people on this globe, every one of them came from a lady. None of them came from a man. There's no such thing as a man chest feeding. Yet they try to tell you that. There was an experiment done years ago. They put about 25 kids in a room, and they had one lie that was being told, and nobody said, no, we don't believe that. And then all of a sudden they had some plants, and this kid goes, well, yeah, well, this and this. And then a second one, yeah, this and this. And before long, they had gone through enough of them, and they all began to agree. And it wasn't long before all 25 of them agreed with the exact same thing. Why? Because they felt the pressure. That's what happens in academia sometimes today. People want to keep their jobs. They want to keep their paychecks coming. So what do? They know that it's nonsense to believe that kind of stuff. There's a guy running for Senate in the state of Texas. He calls himself a Christian. He said this statement, God's non-binary. Only thing I know is the Bible said God identifies as a father. Now, I know he's not a father in as far as like with male reproductive organs. I understand that. But God chose to be identified as a father. And the second person of the Godhead chose to be identified as the son. And so this guy goes, well, there are six genders. And I'm thinking, God said male, God said female. I don't remember the other four. But yet there are people in college campuses that believe that. And so it's a time when, I mean, there's delusions. There was delusions during this time of Jeremiah. You've got this type of thing that's going on. So what are you supposed to do in all of this nonsense? Look at verse 4. First thing I want you to see is we're just supposed to live life. How many of you have ever heard a young couple say this? Man, things are just too bad for us to have any kids right now. Things are just too bad. I don't need to have a wife right now. Things are just too bad. I don't need a husband right now. Listen to what God says. Now remember, they are in captivity. They have been taken in 605, 597, and now this is what Jeremiah is saying. You're in captivity, and how do you know that? Back at verse 1, I'll not go through it, but it says that the words of the letter that I'm sending to those that are in captivity. So we know that he wrote a letter to them, and that letter is now being included in his book. And so he says, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, unto all that are carried away captives, that I have caused to be carried away from Jerusalem unto Babylon. In other words, all you people that are living in despondency, you're discouraged, you've had the life sucked out of you, all of those, what are you supposed to do? Build ye houses. Dwell in them. plant gardens, eat the fruit of them. Take ye wives, beget sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons, and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters, that you may be increased there and not diminished. Do you realize that if Christians don't just get on with life, that you will die by attrition? We will die out. If the young couples in this church, if they don't have kids, where are the Christians gonna come from? Because it doesn't seem to be like we're winning a lot of the world. So we might need to just start having some of our own. Is that not what has happened in Lundestan right now? Is that not what is planned for New York? Plano, Texas? Places like that? Dearborn, Michigan? It's, man, you've got those Islamic women and they're popping them kids out like chiclets. Why is that? Because the more you have, the more votes in 20 years. And what are we doing as Christians? I'm not bringing a kid into this world. Let me tell you, God told these people, you're in captivity, build you a house. Marry your kids off. Get you a wife. Plant you a garden. Eat the fruit of the garden. And so, is there anything wrong with us just enjoying life as good as we can? You know, there's not a whole lot I can do about what's happening on the campus of UCLA. I've never been on the campus of UCLA. I used to love their basketball team when John Wooden was the basketball coach. There was an old book that I have loved. I read it when I was a teenager. I know that Brother Danny Knight, I know he's read it. Because he and I have discussed John Wooden over the years. But we used to love those basketball teams when he won something like 10 national championships in like 11 years. That's unheard of. And I mean, I would stay up late when UCLA would come on television at 11:30 at night just to be able to watch. It used to be Lou Alcindor, then it became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. But I loved Bill Walton. That big red-headed guy, man, he could shoot a basketball. He was a rebounder, and he was a passer. Smart. National championships. I saw him single-handedly win a national championship. He hit something like 22 out of 23 shots in the game that he took. And I don't know anything about UCLA other than eons ago they had a great basketball program. But you hear about some of the things that come off of that campus, and I'm like, man, they're radical. And all I'm thinking is, I can pray for them. But I'm not going out there and doing anything. Let's go plant a tomato plant. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to live my life. I'm going to pray. I'm going to vote. I'm going to do everything that I can do. But ultimately, God caused the people of Israel to go into captivity. Why? Because of their disobedience. But God told them, just live your life. And that's what I'm telling you today. Don't get so discombobulated by the 6 o'clock news. Don't get all frustrated and I just don't know what I'm going to do with my grandbabies. I got five of them. I don't know what I'm going to do either other than just try to live for Jesus before them. Try to raise them and tell them how much Jesus is important in their lives. And hopefully they will get the thinking that I have. That's my prayer. But I'm not going to bemoan the fact that I wished I didn't have any of those kids that's got to grow up in 10 years from now or 20 years from now. No. God told these people to get on with your life. And so, you know what? Let's just get on with our life. Let's live it for the glory of God, and let's teach others to do the exact same thing. My time's already getting away from me. Look at number two. Go down to verse number seven. I want you to remember that he says to listen carefully. He says, now you seek the peace of the city whither I have caused you to be carried away captives. Do you know the city that he's telling them to pray for? The city that he's saying, I want you to have good thoughts about, and you pray for their peace? He's talking about Babylon. This has nothing to do, that statement right there has nothing, zero to do with Jerusalem. This is Babylon. He says, you seek the peace of that city. Why is that? Because if you're at a place and everything is peaceful, that means that you're not in danger as much. And so, I've put you there, so now you pray that it'll be a peace-type atmosphere that you are in. And he says, you pray unto the Lord for it, the city. For in the peace thereof, in that city, shall you have peace. Now this is what he says in verse number 8. He says, let not your prophets or your diviners that be in the midst of you. There were people, prophets, diviners, people that were supposedly the holy men, the spiritual guys. He said, don't you let them sell you a pipe dream. He said, they'll try to deceive you. And he said, don't listen, don't hearken to your dreams which you cause to be dreamed. Now look at verse number 9. They prophesy falsely to you in my name. I hope that you have been around here long enough and have heard me shout this from the pulpit 1,000 times over. That might be a little hyperbole, but not much. I have said this time and time and time again. Don't you believe somebody just because they claim to be a Christian. What does it say in the book of Acts about the Bereans? It says that they search the scriptures daily to see if those things were so. I tell you, and I've told you this humpteen times, don't just believe it because Preacher Tom says it. You search the scriptures yourself because it's in the scriptures that you have life. Now, I think that I've got a wonderful mind. I may lose it one day. I may go off the deep end, get some type of mental problem, and I may say something goofy from this pulpit, and I hope that you have bells and whistles going off in your brain going ding, 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 you know, and a siren, wah, wah. That's not biblical. You listen to what the Word of God has to say first, foremost, always. It's the Word of God. And so just because somebody comes on your computer screen, and they start wanting to tell you about something that is extra biblical. That's one of the problems that I have with the president right now. He has religious people that are surrounding him that are false prophets. I make no apology for saying that. Paula White is a false prophet. Have you heard some of the nonsense she talks about? I'm just telling you, everything that calls themselves a Christian, not necessarily so. There's an old Negro spiritual said everybody talking about heaven ain't going. And you and I need to understand that we listen carefully. We have discerning ears. We don't listen to false prophets. We find somebody and what do? They take the Word of God and you listen to them. And if they're biblical, you follow. If they're non-biblical, you reject it. And so we listen carefully. Let me give you a third thing. Take a long view of Scripture. Look at verse 10. Thus saith the Lord that after 70 years, not two as Hananiah said, 70. This is one of the prophecies that came true, not under the Babylonians, but under the Persians. There's a man named Cyrus. Cyrus, when he conquered the Babylonians, he looked at the Jews and said, go home. And so, he says that 70 years will be accomplished in Babylon. and then I will visit you. That didn't mean that the Lord was going to knock on one of their doors and say, I'm here. It meant that no, God was going to begin to move in that whole nation. And that's exactly what happened when Cyrus gave that edict. You Jews can go back to Jerusalem and to Israel if you want to. You can build your temple. Just go live your life there. Just send us some tax money. That was pretty much it. Babylon was not that way. When Nebuchadnezzar took them, he ravaged them. Cyrus is saying, go home. And it's all because there was a prophecy. Why did God give them 70 years in captivity? Chastisement. But let me tell you, when you have 70 years in your face, you know what was going to happen to these people that had been taken in captivity? Most of them were never going home. If you're 30 years old, you're taken into captivity, you're a carpenter, you're a blacksmith, you work in the palace, and 70 years is going to be accomplished, you're not going back when you're 100, you're not making 100. Only a handful of people make it to 100. None of them back then made it to 100. You know, I mean, very seldom, unless you're talking about pre-flood, do you find anybody that lived that long. Most of the time, it's 70. And now with our modern medicine, we're jumping people up between 80 and 90, and we've got some 90-year-olds, and every once in a while, we've had somebody that's 100. A few days ago, there was a birthday party for J.D. Johnson. He turned 100. J.D. lives up in, I think it's Homer now, and he made 100. But we've had some that have been close recently. We had a 97. We had a 98. But most people don't make that, and they sure didn't make it during these times. Life was hard. They didn't have running water. They didn't have nice showers to step into. They didn't have 6 toilets in their house. They basically went out in the woods. And so you've got 70 years in captivity. Oh, but let me tell you what God said. He said, I know the thoughts that I think toward you. Not the thoughts that you think toward me, but the thoughts that I think toward you. In other words, God knows what he's planning on doing with his people. You say, I've had more trouble in my life than I know what to do with. Can I tell you that God's allowed that? You say, I don't like it. Well, I don't like it either. I didn't like the fact that, you know, whenever I learned about it, as a young kid, and my folks split when I was, you know, probably less than 2. I'm like, well, that's not good. But God made it good. I've had some other things happen in my life. I've had phone calls, and it's like, I hate to be the one to tell you this, but do you know what your kid did? I remember one night I was about to walk out of the house. We were all getting ready to load up in the minivan. Got a phone call. 5:30. Church started at 6 back then. 5:30. Takes me 25 minutes to get to the church. And now I'm going to have to deal with this. And I'm like, dear God, what am I going to do? If I commit murder, I'm going to jail. How am I going to handle this? I mean, we've had heartaches. I mean, I think about what Deb's gone through, and I think she turned the corner 4 or 5 months ago, and she's doing great now. But I'm going to tell you something. For 6.5 years, I wasn't sure if I was going to have a wife. Wasn't sure about that. But yet God made it good. The troubles that we've gone through, God will make it good. He did that with his people here. And can I tell you that they were a covenant people, but we're also a covenant people with the New Testament? The word testament means covenant. We are God's people during the church age. And I thank God for that. So we don't just look at what's happening in the morning. We look at what's happening 5 years from now. We don't look at what's going to happen, you know, in 7 days. We look at what happened 7 years from now. We take a long view. Why? Because all things work together for good to those that love the Lord and to those that are called according to His purpose. You take the long view. Number four and the last thing. Verse number 12. Then you shall call upon me. You shall go and pray unto me, and I will hearken unto you. I'll hear you. You'll seek me and you'll find me. And when you search me for me with all your heart, I'll be found of you. I will turn away your captivity. I will gather you from all the nations, from all the places whither I have driven you. Can I tell you that is a prophecy that is both near and far? That's something that I talk about from time to time when I'm speaking prophetically. This was fulfilled near when they got to go back. And then they were cast out of the land again by the Romans. But in 1948, they got to go back. And that return is still continuing to this day. Why do you think they're building all of these settlements in that nation? Why? Because you've got Jewish people that are wanting to go home. God put it in their heart to go home. And so He said, I'm going to bring you there. I'm going to bring you again into the place whence I caused you to be carried away captive. Now, we've had trouble before in our nation. But I'm just telling you that when you and I, when we just simply live our lives faithfully to God, ultimately it's going to be okay. I mentioned James Garfield earlier. Well, he gave a speech to Congress. And basically, I'm just going to paraphrase it because of time. But he said, in this speech, he said, the people ultimately get the type of Congress that they want. And he said, they really get what they deserve. Now, I don't know if you're old enough to remember this. I know some of you are, if you can remember it. But I remember when both political parties cared about good things. They may have disagreed about how to get to those particular things, but they cared about good things. Many of them really truly wanted to have the best happen for their constituents. Can I tell you, I don't believe any of that happens today. I don't believe it. If you're a congressman, they're going to pay you about $175,000 or $180,000 a year. If you're a senator, you're probably going to make a couple of $100,000. They will spend $25 million to win that seat. That doesn't make sense financially. But you've got so much money that is being pushed this way, pushed that way. You know, you've passed this legislation. We're going to give this money to your PAC. And the next thing you know, you got somebody that comes into Congress and they got, you know, a pot of beans on their stove, and that's about it. And they leave and they got $40 million in the bank. How does that happen? Well, the people voted in that type of leader. And that's what Garfield warned about. But 20 years before that, there was a businessman. And even with the problems that we've had, there have been revivals that took place in this country. 20 years before that speech by James Garfield to Congress, there was a businessman. His name was Lamphere. He was from New York. First name was Jeremiah. And it burdened him that his nation was struggling. He said, we're going through a depression. And they said that the depression during the time of Lamphere, that it was worse than the one that we had historically. And some of you may have had relatives like me that were raised during that. But I've never really suffered a day in my life when it comes to that type of thing. But I mean, the railroads crashed. The banks were crashing. Insurance companies were crashing. People had nothing. They had no jobs. They had nothing as far as the way to sustain themselves. And so what this guy did, he said, I just think we ought to pray. So he began to print some flyers and he put it out. And the first prayer meeting, they had six people. He said, "We're just going to keep praying. We'll meet again." The next week, there was 20. The next week, there was about 100. And it wasn't long before they were having to rent stadiums because there was 4, 5, 6,000 people that were coming from 11 to 12 o'clock to pray for the nation. We came through a civil war on those prayers. And there are some historians that say that all of the blessings that took place from the Industrial Revolution through the early part of the 1900s, all the way up until the 1950s, all of that economic boom that we experienced, it all began because there was a businessman named Jeremiah Lamphere in New York City that started a prayer meeting and was praying for the prosperity of America and for God to bless this nation. Can I tell you, as crazy as it gets sometimes, whether it's in business, and by the way, we're $39 trillion in debt. My great-great-grandkids never going to pay that off, much less you and me. Whether it's economic trouble, whether it's moral trouble, and God knows that we got trouble in that area, political, educational, whatever area you want to go to, there's trouble, but God can straighten it out. In times like these, we need a Savior. That's an old song that's been around 50 years or longer. Be very sure your anchor holds and grips the solid rock. That's the key to that whole song, is you make sure that you have been anchored to the Lord Jesus.